We have been educated for a long time to fit within domination structures, to do what authority says. And when you want people to be nice, dead people and do what authority says, the last thing you want them to be conscious of is the life within them. You can't make a good slave out of somebody who's fully alive. So the last thing you want to teach people, if you want a domination structure, is to be in touch with their needs. You want to teach them that the highest value is not a need to express your needs. Needs means you're needy, selfish, dependent, egotistical. Loving women have no needs. They suppress their needs for their family. Brave men have no needs. They're willing to lose their lives for the king. So that's why we don't know what our needs are. Again, I went to schools for 21 years. Not only was I never asked what I was feeling, I certainly was never asked what my needs were.
The reason why pain that had its roots in childhood was still a living reality causing psychological damage in adulthood was the fact that nature does not allow us to repress suffering with impunity. It's like a debt that has to be paid.
Threw this away.
I did.
Who threw this away? You threw it away? Why?
This one's empty.
Empty? That look empty to you?
Looks empty to me.
Yeah, it looks empty to me too.
Mr. Hotshot, is it empty? Huh? Is it empty?
Dad!
Now. Is it empty?
Stop! Now, Mr. Big Time Hotshot prep school fucker, is it empty? Is it empty?
Huh?
No.
Good. All right. Now clean it out.
Turn around and you're two. Turn around and you're four. Turn around, you're a young man going out of the door.
That's the last time, Bender. That's the last time you ever make me look bad in front of those kids. Do you hear me? I make $31,000 a year and I've got a home and I'm not about to throw it away on some punk like you. But someday, man, someday, when you're out of here and you've forgotten all about this place and they've forgotten all about you and you're wrapped up in your own pathetic life, I'm going to be there. That's right. And I'm going to kick the living shit out of you, man. I'm going to knock your dick in the dirt.
You threatening me?
What are you going to do about it? You think anybody's going to believe you? You think anybody is going to take your word over mine? I'm a man of respect around here. They love me around here. I'm a swell guy. You're a lying sack of shit. And everybody knows it.
Pigtails in petticoats. Where have you gone? Turn around and you're tiny. Turn around and you're grown. Turn around, you're a young wife with me.
See, what's fascinating is the way not only the school, but the entire community seems to be supporting this, you know, or at least turn their heads. I mean, they apparently have permission to use the parking lot.
Right.
No parents seem to mind, you know.
Turn around and you're two. Turn around and you're four. Turn around, you're a young man going out of the door.
Private Pyle, why is your footlocker unlocked?
Sir, I don't know, sir.
Private Pyle, if there is one thing in this world that I hate, It is an unlocked footlocker. You know that, don't you?
Sir, yes, sir.
If it wasn't for dickheads like you, there wouldn't be any thievery in this world, would there?
Sir, no, sir.
Get out! Well, now, let's just see if there's anything missing. Holy Jesus. What is that? What the fuck is that? What is that, Private Pyle?
Sir, jelly donut, sir.
A jelly donut?
Sir, yes, sir.
How did it get here?
Sir, I took it from the mess hall, sir.
Is chow allowed in the barracks, Private Pyle?
Sir, no, sir.
Are you allowed to eat jelly donuts, Private Pyle?
Sir, no, sir.
And why not, Private Pyle?
Sir, because I'm too heavy, sir.
Because you are a disgusting fat body, Private Pyle.
Sir, yes, sir.
Then why did you hide a jelly donut in your footlocker, Private Pyle?
Sir, because I was hungry, sir.
Because you were hungry. Private Pyle has dishonored himself and dishonored the platoon. I have tried to help him, but I have failed. I have failed because you have not helped me. You people have not given Private Pyle the proper motivation. So, from now on, whenever Private Pyle fucks up, I will not punish him. I will punish all of you. And the way I see it, ladies, you owe me for one jelly donut. Now get on your faces. Open your mouth. They're paying for it. You eat it. Ready? Exercise.
One, two, three, four.
Here on code 12, with police action. I mean, the doctors, the staff, they figure that if the police brought you here, there must be a good reason for it.
There isn't a good reason for it. I'm perfectly sane, and I will explain that to them.
Hal, the more you try to act sane, the crazier you start to look. If you smile too much, you're delusional, you're stifling hysteria. And if you don't smile, you're depressed. If you remain neutral, you're emotionally withdrawn, potentially catatonic.
You've given this a lot of thought.
Yeah, I have. Don't you get it? You're code 12, so am I. We're here for the exact same reasons. We both pissed off the cops. You see that lady there? She's married to a cop who kept beating her up. When she tried to tell somebody about it, he brought her here. And that one? Police beat the crap out of her brother. Broke both his arms. And she tried to tell the papers.
And you?
I, work nights.
Sure.
I mean, I work nights.
Oh.
The clubs. Downtown. Nice. Yeah. This one client just kept hitting me and he wouldn't stop. So I filed a complaint. And turns out he was a cop. Next thing I know, I'm here.
But they can't do that.
Are you kidding? Everybody knows women are fragile. And they're all emotions, no logic. There's nothing going on upstairs. Every once in a while they say something that's a little inconvenient. They just go nuts. Pardon my French. If we're insane, nobody has to listen to us. I mean, who are you going to believe? Some crazy woman trying to destroy the integrity of the force? Or a police officer?
doing something here, which I am not doing and I will not do. Throughout these entire broadcasts, you're quoting me out of context, out of order. And I might add, I have participated in all these interviews without a single note in front of me.
Well, it is your life, Mr. President. Now, you've always maintained that you knew nothing about any of this until March 21st. But in February, your personal lawyer came to Washington to start the raising of $219,000 of hush money to be paid to the burglars. Now, do you seriously expect us to believe that you had no knowledge of that?
None. I believe the money was for humanitarian purposes, to help disadvantaged people with their defenses.
Well, it was being delivered on the tops of phone booths with aliases and at airports by people with gloves on. That's not normally the way lawyers' fees are delivered.
Look, I have made statements to this effect before. All that was Haldeman and Ehrlichman's business. I knew nothing. Okay, fine. Fine. You made a conclusion there. I stated my view. Now let's move on. Let's get
No, hold on. Haldeman and Ehrlichman were the ones really responsible. When you subsequently found out about it, why didn't you call the police and have them arrested? Isn't that just a cover-up of another kind?
Well, maybe I should have done that. Maybe I should have just called the feds into my office and said, hey, there's the two men. Haul them down to the dock, fingerprint them, and then throw them in the can. I'm not made that way. These men, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, I knew their families. I knew them since they were just kids. Oh, yeah, but you know, politically, the pressure on me to let them go, that became overwhelming. So I did it. I cut off one arm, then I cut off the other, and I'm not a good butcher. And I have always maintained what they were doing, what we were all doing, was not criminal. Look, when you're in office, you gotta do a lot of things sometimes that are not always, in the strictest sense of the law, legal. But you do them because they're in the greater interests of the nation.
Right, wait, just so I understand correctly. Are you really saying that in certain situations, the president can decide whether it's in the best interests of the nation and then do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
So, Wes, we continue.
Indeed.
Where we left it last time, we talked about these two main hurdles people face when it comes to embracing and working towards a better concept of self. I think that a discussion of each one is very external but can become internal. The other is almost entirely internal. Both worth talking about here in a seventh pillar discussion because they can certainly create frustration and interfere with motivation. So I thought it was worth explaining each one and maybe talking about some remedies for the problems that are created.
Right on, yeah. If knowledge is power, then self-knowledge is even more power, right?
Yeah.
Because we really need to be attuned to what's going on inside of us and aware of these factors that can essentially derail us or take our eyes off the ball, so that we're not actually doing kind things for ourselves anymore, or we're not paying attention to those things that need attention.
Right, yeah. And being neglectful of some of the practices that actually led to making progress. It's certainly easy to backslide with a lot of this stuff when, you know, frustration or obstacles turn up.
Yeah. The first hurdle that we identified is these systems of domination in our midst. And we touched on a lot of those as we went through the Six Pillars series.
Yeah.
Yeah, because those are really noticeable once you take the red pill, if you will. You know, notice all the coercion that's happening on a foundational level in our society, from parenting to schooling to religion to government.
In every case, people are basically being asked, or not asked, asked is the wrong word, forced to sacrifice their own needs, you know, to participate in those arrangements or relationships.
Yeah, because there's lots of punishments, I guess, that are dished out. The carrots and sticks, you know, you've talked about that quite a bit, the conditional rewards and punishments that are offered to people through a process of demands rather than requests. I mean, the difference between a demand and a request is there a punishment if you don't do what's requested, you know, or are you rewarded or something like that? And It's a process that we're so used to. We've normalized a lot of this stuff. So it's really sad that the bulk of the human population doesn't really recognize the harmful effects of all these systems of domination.
So you know? Do you think that that's a fair explanation of what a system of domination is, or does it mean anything else to you? If you wanted to add to that, where the origin of that term came from? Because I know Marshall Rosenberg used it a lot in his discussions of nonviolent communication.
He did. And this is, when we talk about a system, we're talking about what are humans doing to perpetuate a set of rules or behaviors that have been seen as somehow useful. So any kind of system kind of begets more of itself. But it can be a set of beliefs, you know, a belief system to perpetuate the system of rules that have been imposed or the roles that people are in a domination system. It uses power over strategies rather than power with strategies, which is the term that NVC uses as well. So with power with, there is no sacrifice of a person's needs or a group's needs. It's win-win.
Yeah.
But with the domination system, it's essentially win-lose because things are not done in a voluntary fashion and the requests are not made in a way that attunes to the needs that align the yes or the no to the request, but rather there's demands and then there's punishments that are dished out. So yeah, it's interesting. It's sort of a chicken and egg thing, you know, which came first, the system or the humans that are driving that system.
Oh, that's a really interesting question that would be fun and exciting to get into, because first of all, just back to Rosenberg for a minute, he did a workshop in the late 90s called Anger and Domination Systems. And he said in that workshop, by systems, I mean governments, organizations, institutions that regulate human affairs. Still quoting Rosenberg, in his books, The Powers That Be and Engaging the Powers, theologian Walter Wink talks about domination systems being ones in which a few people control many to their own advantage. In domination systems, you have to train people to think in ways that support the system so that they fit the system. Domination systems require, number one, suppression of self, number two, moralistic judgments, number three, Amtssprach. Are you familiar with that term? It's German.
It's German, meaning sort of the rules of the workplace, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It was...
doing my job. It's the law. Those kinds of things that deny responsibility.
Deny responsibility choice. And deny choice, absolutely. I think the term actually refers to the bureaucratic language of the Nazis.
Uh-huh.
So we know lots of words that fit into that, like should, have to, ought. And
company policy, you know, it's like a workplace bureaucratic mindset that dilutes each person's responsibility.
Oh, yeah. That's only gotten worse. I remember when you used to be able to call people on the phone who were representatives of companies and negotiate with them. And I'm not saying it's impossible today, but it's certainly harder to do, right? Because they have that escape hatch called company policy or some variant of that.
Yes, as well as sending you down this phone tree in which you finally get hung up on.
Yeah, that's another trick. And then beyond Amtssprach, the fourth one that he mentions as an attribute of a domination system is the concept of deserve.
Mm, deserve-oriented thinking.
Yeah.
Yes, they deserve to be punished, because if they don't deserve to be punished, then why are you doing it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
So yeah, it's all kind of wrapped up in all of those denial of responsibility and deserve-oriented thinking and demand-oriented positions. It just kind of plays off each other to prevent people from realizing what's actually happening.
Yeah.
You know, there's a rationalization process that's going on for people to make this somehow seem useful.
So we elaborated on the third and the fourth one. Anything to add on this concept of, you know, suppression of self? I touched on it when I said, you know, you're not going to be able to meet your own needs. In fact, participation in one of these domination systems at times, I think, even requires a denial that you have them, you know, feelings and needs, because there's no place for them to go.
Yeah, you really can't assert that, you know, the practice of self-assertiveness really suppress there, because you cannot really assert the needs that are being sacrificed lest you cause disruption in the system. You know, the system seeks homeostasis, right? It wants to keep with the status quo. And so any dissenter gets vilified typically, you know,
right.
Rocking the boat. And that's obviously really prevalent in family systems. The person who brings up the harmful behavior of the other person, or the abuse or the neglect or the, you know, who knows, molestation or something, somehow becomes the person who is vilified rather than the person that's perpetrating those actions.
Yeah, it really segues nicely from, you know, the first attribute of a domination system, what we're talking about, to the second attribute, moralistic judgments, right?
Yeah, yeah. You kind of require good and bad people, or these labels to put on people in order to administer punishments or rewards accordingly, so that everyone toes the party line. And, you know, there's tons of servility and just slavish obedience. For what? You know, that question, for what? Why are we doing this, is really frowned upon. You know, it starts in the family. It blends right into religion. You know, families typically indoctrinate kids with various religions that frown upon questioning any kind of serious principles involved in the matter. Like, trying to reason from first principles is darn near impossible when you're in a supernatural sort of realm, when you have to sort of abandon your rational faculty to indulge in the mystical thoughts and feelings and so forth. And it is kind of ironic that Walter Wink, a theologian, brought up the nature of domination systems without, you know, pointing out that religions have been huge domination systems in human being suffering, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, look at all the wars, the holy wars, and what's going on today, even, you know, all this religious stuff. And of course, the biggest, baddest religion of them all is statism.
Yeah.
It's not really recognized as such, but there's all the symbols, there's all the rituals, there's all the punishment, except it's punishment in this life rather than the supposed next one.
Oh, you know, just on Walter Wink, he did better than just kind of a passing glance or happening to notice, you know, these things. I mean, he was very in touch with this idea that I actually have a quote, something that he said. Bear with me while I try to pull it up. But he was very in touch with this problem.
A lot of theologians are so versed in the religious stuff that they tend to become atheistic, or at least probably a sizable minority of them.
Right. He said, basically, as the story of human history, you know, going back 1,000 years BC, quote, "the story that rulers of domination societies told each other and their subordinates is what we today might call the myth of redemptive violence. It enshrines the belief that violence saves, that war brings peace, that might makes right. It is one of the oldest continuously repeated stories in the world." And this possibly opens us up into a very, very big historical topic here. It's worth pointing out that last year, Daryl Becker, Tony Myers, and I did a series responding to some criticism we got for trying to talk about nonviolent communication, basically in concert with a critical thinking or learning methodology called the Trivium. There were some people who didn't like this, and a lot of characters were brought into that discussion by the people who were criticizing us. One of them was a woman named Rianne Eisler. Are you familiar with her?
Just vaguely. We've talked about her a little bit.
Yeah, I think we only have to be vaguely familiar with her, but she did a lot of work on contrasting, first of all, identifying domination systems and contrasting them with what she called partnership cultures.
Okay.
Right.
And sounds pretty copacetic.
Okay. But then there's sort of political implications of that. Like, how does a domination system become a partnership culture? And, you know, what else is tied to her vision of what society should be?
Yeah. Is there some sort of package deal with some elements of coercion, some institutions involved, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. So there's some of these global think tanks like, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations. And I think Eisler was part of one called the Club of Rome, which had some, you know, nefarious designs on reducing the world's population. So is somebody kind of a, you know, a passing member, or they just have a loose curiosity about what goes on in a group like that? Or is it, you know, an important core of what they believe, something like eugenics? Mm-hmm. there are questions, I think people are right to be suspicious about Eisler, but this idea of we need to get rid of domination systems and return to partnership cultures because that's what existed pre-civilization. I don't really know if that's realistic because right now we're post-civilization. So this kind of brings in characters like Terence McKenna, and his archaic revival, you know, a return to the way things were before we before we had anything, before we stopped anywhere, before we built anything as a civilization. So I think there's a kind of hokiness to it.
And yeah, didn't I hear a quote? Was it on Duncan's show or maybe it was Chris Ryan's, tangentially speaking? There was a clip that they played of, I think it was Terrence McKenna saying that, you know, basically advocating genocide of the male population in order to bring things back to normal or something.
But, you know, if you look at his whole life and all the things that he said, he was a little bit wishy-washy.
Yeah, it goes back and forth. There's really great, enriching quotes. And then that one, I think that's who they were, the audio they were playing.
It is McKenna because he did say things like that. But then he was like a huge fan of Rianne Eisler. And he, you know, he would look at her work. He praised her, pointing out the difference between the dominator culture and the partnership culture. And Eisler even said, you know, it's not ideology, it's not gender, it's not race specific. It's just like any human being has the propensity to dominate other human beings if they're put in the right conditions. I mean, that's what she believed.
Yeah, Stanford prison experiment, right?
Exactly. So yep. I from that other series, thank heavens for Evernote, because I have notes. I just searched McKenna. On Eisler's work, he says, "I don't see it as a male disease. I think everybody in this room has a far stronger ego than they need." The great thing that Rianne Eisler, in her book, The Chalice and the Blade, did for this discussion was to de-genderize the terminology. Instead of talking about patriarchy and all this, what we should be talking about is dominator versus partnership society. So even there, that's, you know, a contradiction to a call for male genocide, which is something that he yes. did basically say, you know, somewhere else.
Yeah, like the males are the lesser of the species, in a sense.
Right.
I mean, statistically, look at who's involved in the wars, all the crime, prisons are filled predominantly with males. So there's obviously some memes going on there, not necessarily human nature, but the systems that people are in. Men are supposed to be strong and not really show emotion other than anger. And that can lead to, you know, being in systems of domination and forcing your will upon others.
Right. And I think that instead of talking about, you know, going backwards to the kind of societies that human beings had when they were nomadic, it might be necessary to recognize certain types of domination systems as, you know, a kind of ugly side effect in the evolution of a species, and that they were evolutionary steps, not pretty ones, but now something that we need to you know, try to evolve beyond instead of going back behind. You know, like yeah. these cultures, the domination systems historically spring up when human beings basically domesticate at the time of the agricultural revolution. So suddenly you have a dependable food supply, and then mm-hmm. societies can grow larger and more stuck in one place.
With lots of stored goods, you know, property becomes a very valuable thing mm-hmm. that can be traded and also looted.
Yeah. Other crafts can develop around that phenomenon taking place. But, you know, now with this stability and this growth in society, people have possessions that are basically worth fighting for. So the historians talk, or it might have even been Eisler who pointed this out, that around this time, you start to see these technological developments of, you know, trenches and ramparts, things that had never existed before in human history, are propping up because people are fighting over resources. But
yeah, it's all old men talking and young men dying, basically.
Mm-hmm. So you could say that it's still a kind of progress. It's just happening in a situation, in a time where people have no philosophy. Well, we know the answer that eventually came post-Babylon. It was Judaism, and then it was Christianity, and then it was Islam, and then it was, you know, the religions of the classical world that all tried to explain this and create rules for it. But domination systems, the kinds of systems that in one form or another we still live with today, spring up in that time, pre-philosophy. And now I think it's a question of how do we use that philosophical evolution to move beyond these domination systems, not to this ancient archaic revival idea of partnership cultures, even though they might have some benefits, but we want to keep going forward.
Yeah, and they're kind of overlooking some of the constraints that were in those partnership systems. You know, the potential ostracism or even death if you disagreed with the rules or norms in the system there too. Mm-hmm. I addressed some of that in the Psychology of Liberty because I wanted to look at the history of you know, primitive tribes, and there was more autonomy granted and choice granted to people in those tribal societies. However, there were some pretty strong rules or constraints, you know, mores people are supposed to toe, you know, to toe that line once again. And, you know, your quote by Walter Wink reminded me of George Orwell's book, 1984, which I played an excerpt of on my Complete Liberty podcast, episode 191, which I titled Peace, Freedom, Strength, and the Orwellian Nightmare. Mm. But in that book, you know, he has these turns of phrase, war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength.
Right.
And there was a sort of a re-education camp called the Ministry of Love, fittingly enough, where the Stockholm Syndrome was fostered through torture. So it wasn't to extract confessions or to punish per se, but rather to change the mind of the tortured. Quote, so long as he resists us, we never destroy him. We bring him over to our side. We make the brain perfect before we blow it out. In other words, perfectly obedient.
Isn't that ugly?
Horrific. Leave it to Orwell to really describe the nuances, the psychological nuances of that process of just servitude, of not speaking one's mind, that true self part of oneself that really wants to make sense of things, wants to live consciously, wants to make sense of things, wants to figure it out, you know?
Yeah, our context here, it's very difficult to make that transition from a time in life where we're too young to have any say or to, you know, argue back effectively, transitioning from self-denial to self-exploration.
Yeah, it's what Orwell described here in this quote is like the nadir of human functioning in terms of self-esteem, where they say, never again will you be, and they're talking to, I believe, Winston, this main character in the book, never again will you be capable of ordinary human feeling. Everything will be dead inside you. Never again will you be capable of love or friendship or joy of living or laughter or curiosity or courage or integrity. You will be hollow. We shall squeeze you empty, and then we shall fill you with ourselves. The big brother is the embodiment of the party.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, political systems can be by far the biggest domination systems on the planet. I mean, millions and millions of human beings have died under their influence.
Yeah, and I mean, even for people in America, fortunately, what you just read from Orwell still might sound a little cartoony, a little far-fetched, you know, a little like fiction.
And that's a system that's getting people to think that way, to downplay the significance of the reality of those systems, which have actually existed. People have had their brains blown out, literally, and been tortured, and they're being tortured today as we speak.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that was written in the 1950s, but it describes North Korea yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Almost perfectly, you know,
we'll
empty you and fill you with ourselves. Nailed it. And I mean, you know, that's what he was criticizing, which is why we used to read those books in American public schools. We don't anymore. But, you know, he was a socialist who was critical of the full step to communism, as he was seeing with Stalin. And that's why he wrote that. That's what he saw happening. And it certainly still exists in the world today. And I think it's a matter of degrees.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not North Korea, but I think that even though that might sound a little bit far-fetched, there's parts of that that should resonate with people, especially if they are, you know, trapped in the schools or someplace like the military.
Yeah, well, or any third world country, even China. You know, what happens if you disagree with members of the Communist Party that are in your community?
Mm-hmm.
They block parts of the internet there. So freedom of speech, freedom of press is out the window. There are really, really strong elements of domination systems in our midst. And as I pointed out in Complete Liberty Inside Out, my third chapter, I kind of like go through the range of domination systems, except for the schooling one. I dedicate a whole chapter to that one. But it's important to understand that this stuff originates in family systems where kids are not encouraged to be curious and to speak their minds freely and openly and to disagree with their parents so that we can all learn things, you know. And there's a lot of punishments, whether they be, you know, hitting kids, spanking, as it's euphemistically called, or imposing timeouts or taking away rewards or privileges. All those kinds of things are ways that, you know, we tragically try to get some needs met. Maybe some needs for order, or maybe the parents are looking for some empathy or understanding or appreciation, you know, those kinds of needs. But as Rosenberg pointed out, conflict happens on the level of strategies, not needs, because we all have these needs that can be fulfilled if we attune to the strategies that are win-win rather than the ones that are domination-oriented, power over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the current family systems and the current school system are really, you know, preventing young people from realizing potential intellectually and emotionally and in terms of self-discovery. There's really no encouragement for that.
No. There's another powerful quote from Orwell here. How does one man assert his power over another? By making him suffer. Obedience is not enough. Unless he is suffering, how can you be sure that he is obeying your will and not his own? Power is in inflicting pain and humiliation. Power is in tearing human minds into pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. Do you begin to see then what kind of world we are creating? So how to switch from that sort of horrific power over strategy to a power with, you know, where people are feeling secure in their ability to get needs met. There's not the rampant distrust and fear of others that seems to be pretty prevalent in our culture still.
And what does the power with look like? What are the attributes of that?
Well, it's honoring the other person with a sense of equality and mutuality and respect, which gets back to self-esteem, that I value your mind like I value my mind, that it's competent to think and judge the facts of reality, and that your person is worthy of happiness, which precludes using any sort of domination strategies against you, because I know that is not only win-lose, but lose-lose, because it's not honoring my need to respect you.
Mm-hmm.
We have a need to respect others, just as we have a need to respect ourselves. So power with is sharing in our mutual beneficial empowerment perspectives, on sharing the need for self-esteem, essentially, not sacrificing it.
And the family is the place where this really needs to start.
It really does. And unfortunately, because children lack experience and they're developing in ways that aren't as mature as adults, they can be looked down upon or not treated with equal respect, mutual, you know, concern and appreciation and so forth. You know, they lack knowledge. So it's almost easy to impart knowledge to children in a sort of domination way. Sometimes, like, I know best.
Yeah.
And this is for your own good, that I can see farther in the future or further in the future than you can. So I'm making these judgments on your behalf to spare you the harm done through your own judgment that's really immature. But how are they going to learn to exercise mature judgment? How are they going to esteem themselves in that process? Makes it really, really difficult, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Can I ask you this? Like, I know you spend a lot of time combing through the web. Are you finding examples of people who are making this process with their children public that you think are really positive models for people who want to have these connections? I think most people want to have these connections with their children, and they wind up, I've certainly seen it in my own life, doing behaviors that are more automatic. Like, this is how I was parented. This is what's familiar to me. This is what I'm going to pass along. But there's a lot of people who, you know, talk about unschooling or talk about, you know, real world education and peaceful parenting. Can you think of some examples or some resources that we could point people to?
In public, I would have to look into that. I have had multiple clients that are raising kids in this freedom-oriented fashion, respect-oriented fashion. And simultaneous to that, it takes that therapeutic process of reparenting oneself so that one doesn't get triggered and feel really disempowered or overwhelmed in the midst of parenting. So it is a work in progress. But yeah, I've definitely known people that are presently engaged in this process. I'm not sure to what extent they've made it public. I'm thinking Rosalyn Ross, for sure, her and Tom. They're down, I think, in Nicaragua now with their little boy.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote a book called The Theory of Objectivist Parenting. And I believe she was at the Atlas Society conference in New Hampshire?
Yep.
Yeah, she's done some panel discussions. There's some YouTubes of her. Yeah, she really has put a lot of thought into this process of equality and mutual respect. I could definitely direct people to her resources.
She has a website, doesn't she?
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I think it's. It was called Philosophical Parenting, but I'll have to check on that. I definitely put it in the show notes.
And our friend Kevin Geary has his site Revolutionary Parent.
Yeah, absolutely,
which is a great
Kevin
resource.
Geary. Another one.
And yeah, I just wanted to focus on that. I mean, I think when it comes to schooling, religion, and government, those are huge topics when it comes to outlining systems of domination. We've both covered them before in great detail, but I really wanted to devote our attention here to the one that is the most foundational, that makes the rest of the domination systems really make sense, which is abusive and neglectful parenting, or even just maybe absorbing and repracticing some suboptimal strategies that we learned from our parents, that they learned from their parents.
Yeah, the intergenerational transfer effect,
yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I can recommend Geary's podcast. I think it used to be called Reboot Your Kids, but it's Powerful Parenting Podcast now, I think.
The website is revolutionaryparent.com, and the podcast is the same.
Yeah, Revolutionary Parent Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely look into that, because he has two kids now,
mm-hmm.
Little ones, and he's in this process of reparenting and bringing them into the world in a new way without the domination systems.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's been really public about that, and I really appreciate his message. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of determination to go against the cultural grain, you know?
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, one of the factors in the self-esteem process for the seventh pillar is the willingness to stand alone sometimes, even opposed to those we may love.
You yeah.
know, to trust your own judgment about something that's really important in terms of principles, but also to maintain an empathetic and compassionate perspective on the opposition. Why are they taking the stance that they are, you know?
Sure, yeah. It becomes a real challenge in a family system when you have parents who are watching how you are doing things with your own children, and you have siblings. These are stories that people have told me who also have children but have a different approach. And I think it does, you know, take some courage and conviction not to do those things in your own home, because you want to do those things. Those are the relationships that you tried to build with your children, but to, you know, express that to other people in your family, because I think people often interpret it as a kind of judgment against them or a criticism against them. You're not doing things like the rest of the family does.
Yeah. And so the idea of rocking the family boat comes up.
Right.
And there the child senses this love withdrawal, perhaps, or being frowned upon or being ridiculed or punished in some way if they go against what the system is. And the parents may have a lot of fears about changing the system. They may fear what their spouse is going to think if they throw a wrench in the typical way of doing things, upsetting the balance, you know? These systems really tend to perpetuate themselves.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. That's a really difficult situation to be in, to become aware of all of this in the midst of a marriage, in the midst of trying to raise children.
Yeah. So, yeah, how to meet one's need for openness and for clarity, for meaning and understanding in the midst of a system that has been not so nurturing of those needs or having a definite different take on them. Yeah, I was thinking of the Mormon religion. I remember when you and Jeremy were on the show together, right?
Yeah.
On Complete Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
I did a series on religion and nonviolent communication, or the ethics of religion and so forth. And the Mormon community really has those ties that bind in terms of sacrificing the need for self-assertiveness and clear meaning about things.
Yeah, and you're kind of lost without it.
Yeah, they set up whole communities based around their religion. So what happens if you disagree on the fundamentals?
Maybe not always. And I think this is true, obviously, beyond Mormonism, but you're trading self-awareness for a sense of belonging or the avoidance of aloneness, the avoidance of isolation.
Yes.
So it's very counter self-esteem.
It is. It is a trade-off that doesn't need to happen, actually. We can strive for the win-win interactions and realize that, you know, others have their own stuff to process as well. So they may not go on this journey at the same time that we do. But every time we take those steps in that realm of self-esteem, we know that we're benefiting ourselves and our happiness and the people that we interact with.
Have you ever had any conversations that you would be willing to or would be able to share here with people who are, say, college age or younger about trying to develop these win-win interactions or these win-win relationships with their parents? Because I think, you know, right up until somebody leaving college, there still is the existence in most cases of that power over dynamic in many respects.
Yeah, and sometimes purse strings still.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Which really make people disinclined to speak their minds freely and disagree and so forth.
Yeah, and I've had a lot of interactions with people who have parents who know that and who use that. And that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I've had a handful of conversations delving into these things pretty deeply. And I'm sad that the parents typically aren't up for the journey to really heal and grow in this process. There's a lot of defenses come up in this process. At times, there's signs of change, but a lot of the times the person post-adolescence is on their own, you know, to really strive to make their lives the best they can be and to free themselves from the constraints and just the nature of the system that's kind of discouraged them from really self-actualizing.
Yeah, and that's not limited to parents. I mean, I think we've learned that there's relatively few people who want to make that journey. And right now, with the realization of all these things, a lot of us are just trying to find and connect with people who are. And fortunately, that's, like I said in an earlier show, it's an easier thing to do today, but it's really, really essential. Like, yes, sometimes we do have to stand alone, but being able to develop a support system, or if we've endured a significant amount of trauma, finding that pro-recovery environment and pro-recovery community is really, really essential.
Does it mean that you need to go up to the Yukon Territory and build yourself a tiny home and never to see civilization again?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it relates to, loosely, something that my first webmaster told me at this point almost 7 years ago. Why do you spend all this time trying to convince your family of your political beliefs? You know, go find people who already agree with you and try to build something with them. You know, that kind of idea. And that's not just politically or entrepreneurially, but I think it's really emotionally too. You know, like, those are the people we should be. I'm not advocating, you know, complete disconnection from people unless it's really necessary because they're physically or emotionally abusive. But maybe redirecting that attention that we kind of run into this wall, but we continue to run when it comes to a lot of these blood relations. And I really don't think we need to, but I would have had a really, really hard time with that at the age of 20, especially being 20 in, you know, 1997, when the world didn't seem so open and accessible as it didn't for most people who existed, which is, you know, I think a big part of the reason why, back to the domination systems, why we inherit a lot of this.
Yeah. Yeah. And it leads us to the second hurdle that we're facing, which is a kludgy brain of sorts.
That's
the haphazard evolution of the human mind, as Gary Marcus's subtitle to his book Kludge is.
Yeah, perhaps a much more significance and at least for the time being, irreparable kind of inheritance that we do have to acknowledge and deal with.
Yeah, so Marcus is a psych professor at NYU, I believe, and in his book Kludge, he focuses on aspects that are more cognitive than emotional, it seems, but also sort of misdirected through the emotional process as well. And that kind of dovetails into our discussions about self-esteem. But he covers topics such as memory and belief and choice and language, pleasure, things fall apart, true wisdom, that's in the table of contents. It's an interesting read because it shows from a psychology point of view and a neuroscience point of view that our brains are not elegantly designed or in a way that's most efficient for optimal functioning, for integration. You know, we need to actually work on this stuff. We need to expend effort, and doubly so when we've been raised in domination systems. You know, it makes it harder. Like, if we were able to dissolve these domination systems that we've been talking about that are external to us, it would make it so much easier to nurture ourselves and to find that integration that is necessary for really true self-leadership rather than you know, hunkering down with various defenses, rationalizing, denial, dissociating, and kind of kidding ourselves about how that's actually helping us.
Yeah.
In some way it is. I mean, they're survival strategies when we're in a domination system, but they're not going to really align us with what's in our best interests.
Right.
So your discussion of like still keeping ties with people that aren't so interested in these topics, don't really want to focus on self-knowledge and interchange reminds me of the phrase, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually literally experienced that. So you're standing there at a pool of water. It looks really, really great to drink. And the horse is just standing there not wanting to drink. So at some point you make a decision, okay, we're not going to stand here anymore and move on. So go where the gold is. Go where the people that are really curious and interested in these things, because that's going to benefit you the most, obviously. And to express your remorse about not being able to connect on these levels that are really important. And on some level, they know it too. You know, the true self, or what Brandon calls a sage self, has this wisdom. This inner wisdom is in each person to really identify. And we'll kind of discuss that in another show about some of the alternative strategies or the solutions to these various hurdles that we're up against.
And, you know, I'm thinking now when I bring up that advice that my webmaster gave me so many years ago, it was kind of a coldly logical solution that really doesn't, it's almost like this person kind of escaped the Kluge brain, right? That I have this, I'm prioritizing blood relations, which is certainly, you know, a kind of biological drive to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, redirecting this effort, extra effort in attention into that, even though it only usually results in frustration, but these are extra important people. So how rational to say, well, just move on to more interested humans, you know?
Uh-huh.
But that's not exactly how the brain works, you know? I mean, you said this, first of all, this Kluge is an engineering term, and
yes,
it refers to, you know, a solution that's kind of clumsily assembled from what materials are available, you know?
Duct tape, bubble gum, baling wire, those kinds of things, a random screw, hammer.
Yeah, exactly. So what we wind up with, it's hard to believe, especially after, you know, everything I just learned in that memory series that I did about this kind of magnificence of the human mind. We have brains that are built more for short-term surviving than they are for long-term thriving and even learning, you know? So yes, find your blood and stick to them. That is, you know, the Kluge brain speaking up over reason, over, you know, finding what is for me a more beneficial and workable solution in a way.
Yeah, it is interesting, you know, reflecting on your series on memory, this process of remembering things through a mental map or visual image and tagging the terms or things you want to remember with these really strange, unique, out of the ordinary images and so forth and names. Like that's an example of kludginess, right? Because you're trying to remember something by remembering a whole bunch of other stuff or associating it with all these other things that, you know, computer memory doesn't need to retain all that extraneous stuff in order to recall something that's been placed in its memory. Yeah, Marcus gets into that and, you know, the parallels with computers and the differences that computer memory has to human memory are really interesting. But nonetheless, we're imaginative beings, and we really develop these mental maps, time and space and so forth, on a primitive level in order to survive.
So that
that stays with us.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody about that, and I was explaining, because this concept of like the memory palace, you know, placing items in some kind of visual imagination construction, it sounds far-fetched. It sounds counterintuitive. It sounds like way too much work to actually do to remember something. It's like, well, I'll make a linear list. But our minds work like that because those were necessary mental skills to develop for survival. And I was talking to somebody about this, and they said, oh, yeah, this is why men are better at navigation than women. I don't want to say who this person is, but I said, what do you mean?
Better at navigation.
Well, I don't know.
Has that been scientifically proven?
No, of course not. Of course not. But they said, yeah, it's because I just thought it was an interesting thing to throw out without any evidence. And sometimes that's fine just to kind of turn on the thoughts. You know, you wouldn't want to give a presentation on one of these things because that would be silly. But he goes, oh, yeah, men are much better at navigation because, you know, our brains develop to hunt and go out and find food. So we have more like visual spatial memories, which isn't really true. Like all human beings have these memories because whether it was hunting or gathering, understanding the lay of the land was essential for the survival of the entire species. I thought it was an interesting kind of conjecture. But yeah, I mean, that's why our minds work like that, because it was just about getting to the next day. And, you know, that's a kind of mentality that, even though is not really necessary anymore, it certainly survives right up until the 21st century, from its origins hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years ago.
Yeah, perhaps that person would find Delusions of Gender, Cordelia Fine's book,
interesting. Yeah, we talked about her on the show years ago.
Yeah, really important critique of all these notions of gender differences from a neuroscientific point of view, and she debunks all of it. We all have the capacity to reason, and I've known quite a few female hunters in my time. Matter of fact, my mom is a hunter. So, it's belied by a lot of the evidence. And the fact that we have reasoning minds in our species, there's not like a lopsided thing that human, you know, we need to have this consistent reasoning capacity in our species in order to interact, obviously. So that's been an adaptive trait that's evolved with us too. It's interesting because I don't know if there's any kind of psychological studies that have been done with like chimps, male and female chimps. Do they have different reasoning capacity, or not reasoning, but sort of cognitive or emotional capacities? You know, like look at the other great apes. But once we acquire the capacity to reason, we now have an adaptive trait, these frontal lobes, that's able to forecast and think in abstract ways and imagine things that other animals simply don't. So with that capacity comes a lot of potential difficulties in staying attuned to really what matters. And obviously humans can rationalize anything, kind of in the short term, I guess, an adaptive trait sometimes, to think that somehow these justifications are helping us. But long term, it's a maladaptive characteristic of this adaptive trait called volitional reasoning consciousness.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Our minds are like the one part of our bodies that, in retrospect, we actually get angry at, you know?
Exactly.
Because of their, you know, it's not to say that there aren't kludges all over the human body, you know? I mean, everything, this actually is from a review of the book. The reviewer writes, "Evolution kludges its solutions because it only has the crudest tools at its disposal, genetic mutations and millions of years. Natural selection can select only from what genetic accidents have made available, and the features it chooses may remain in place not because they are optimal, but because evolution just didn't find a better way." So there we are.
Yeah, and the way it did find was adaptive. It led to the survival of that species.
So what were some important takeaways from Kluge for you?
Well, it just kind of reaffirmed some of the reasons why it's difficult for humans to step out of the status quo and to think differently. Like, he has a list of 13 recommendations to deal with our kludgy minds. Most of them are kind of like cognitive perspectives, like consider alternative hypotheses, which means, you know, not engaging in confirmation bias, reframe the question, rethinking what's asked or posed, you know, kind of distilling the principles involved. Correlation does not equal causation. You know, that's one of the fallacies we see quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Pay attention to non sequiturs, you know, something that doesn't logically follow something else. Never forget the size of the sample and thus the external validity and the pitfalls of Aunt Millie stories, you know, basically ways of explaining something that are just, what's the term?
Okay, can you describe it?
So instead of a scientific explanation, it's a...
anecdote?
An anecdote, yeah, anecdotal evidence. That's the Aunt Millie stories. I get that Aunt Millie phrase from Barry Sears in his Zone book.
Or some of the foundational studies on IQ being done with six children.
Exactly.
Yes. True story.
Anticipate your own impulsivity.
Good one.
And pre-plan or commit to what you truly value. So really keep your eye on the goals that you've set and those impulse buys at the grocery stores, you know, not so enriching in the long term. And don't just set goals, make specific contingency plans. Don't decide or think while you're tired or distracted.
Right.
Concentrate when rested. You know, that's really important. Always weigh benefits against the costs. Consider the opportunity costs. And that's, you know, it's a huge one in the realm of statism, right? People aren't considering the opportunity costs of statism, like what we could have in our world if we didn't have coercion at the foundation, the punishment model, you know, the whole system of domination. Like, how much opportunity are we missing out on? It's huge.
Absolutely, yeah.
I would guess that Gary Marcus doesn't even realize it, because most of these mainstream professors are just out to lunch in this philosophical realm.
There's a chapter in your first, or in the first Complete Liberty, about that, called Imagine a Free World, that probably could be a far more spectacular chapter, you know, 8 or 9 years later.
Fleshed it out. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just with everything that's developed in that time.
Yeah, it'd be way beyond what Elon Musk is offering through Tesla.
Sure, sure.
So imagine that your decisions are going to be spot checked by someone else for accountability purposes. So that's important. You know, kind of a different perspective helps in optimizing our decisions. Distance yourself in order to value long-term goals along with short-term pleasures. So look at things objectively. Step out of the immediate, right, and look at the longer perspective.
Yeah, hard to do sometimes.
Hard to do, yeah, especially when we have those short-term pleasures right there in the hand.
Yeah.
Beware the vivid, the personal, and the anecdotal. Take time to reflect on the impersonal but scientific. So again, developing this more objective mindset. Pick your spots of what needs attending to. Reserve your most careful decision-making for the choices that matter most. So allocate your willpower, if you will, and concentration to things that really matter. And then finally, try to be rational. Most people aren't a lot of the time, quote, which is why we need schools, not just Wikipedia and an internet connection. He actually said that.
Yeah,
he's not aware of the nature of those domination systems in people's midst that are detracting from the ability to actually live authentically, relating to themselves and to others authentically.
Mm.
So obviously all of these recommendations are bringing awareness to our brains about our brains, you know, challenges, our capacities to not really attuned to these things. So as we create more awareness, it's like the fallacies, right? If you study the fallacies, cognitive fallacies, you become more aware of when they actually come out of your mouth or when you type them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the benefit of the sentence completion exercises that Brandon offers too, because you're now aware of the subtleties of your emotions, the little things that are being said in part of your mind, your mind's eye. You can just attune to those things, become more aware of them so that they are not so controlling of your behavior and your moods and your train of thought and all those things.
Yeah. You know, having a confidence in one's own intellect and having some philosophical direction, as I'm reading this list, it's so helpful because there's so much good work out there that other people have done, but so much of it requires just the most delicate pruning. You know, I mean, everybody from Marcus to Rand, you got to have your little shears out here
and
there.
You really do. Yeah. Little nip and tuck here and there.
And it's nice when you can see, we were talking about this before we started recording, it's also nice when you can see somebody's work evolve over time, like I think Brandon's did.
Yeah, mine has too.
Sure.
You know, out of the domination thinking, you know, from Complete Liberty, talking about, you know, what is moral, what is immoral, and so forth, to the win-win strategies that NBC offers us.
Sure. I met somebody out in the seacoast here in New Hampshire. His name was Lawrence. He was a friend of yours. And he said, I knew Wes when he was a conservative. And I said,
conservative.
I said, that's what I said. I said, no, I don't think so. And he goes, well, not a conservative, but you know, close.
Close. That's hilarious. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, he writes for Strike the Root. He's a very colorful writer.
Yeah, Lawrence Ludlow, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, medieval scholar.
Yes, yes, that's right. He and I do need to connect eventually to dig into that.
Yeah, lots of fascinating things to discuss.
Very fun.
But yeah, never really conservative. I guess, yeah, more in that moralistic judgment mode. And it's something that's a work in progress, obviously, all the time, especially if you're driving in California traffic.
Right, right, exactly.
Fortunately, I moved to a different location that doesn't require so much bumper-to-bumper stuff. But yeah, to really take that compassionate time in to that part that really wants to be critical or judge good or bad, right, wrong, you know, to step out of that paradigm and into a realm where needs can be nurtured.
Mm-hmm.
A field beyond right doing and wrong doing. I'll meet you there. That Sufi poet Rumi said.
That's a fine transition, I think, into the next show, where I really want to dig into the work of Dr. Daniel Siegel and the wheel of awareness, this,
yeah,
you know, meditation,
love to go through that with you.
Mindfulness practices that we've talked about before. But I think it really fits here. And he also has a resource on his webpage, the Healthy Mind Platter, about achieving a balanced life. And I also I also dug into one of his books called Brainstorm that I think we should get into as well.
Nice.
So
he identifies 8 senses. So reflect on that.
Interesting. And there's more to do with that. You know, beyond Siegel, we can talk about self-regulation therapy, and you even wanted to touch on psychedelics, which I think will be fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. The therapeutic use of psychedelics. There's kind of an upsurge in talking about this and using it.
Absolutely.
But I guess, to wrap up the whole kludginess of the brain thing, it's important to accept the metaphysically given, accept that we're fallible, as Edelstein says, imperfect humans. I re-listened to that interview he did with Tom Woods, by the way, and took a few notes. Yeah, I didn't want to mischaracterize his perspective, but I tell you, he really conflates different points of view and doesn't really define self-esteem in the way that Brandon does. He talks about thinking highly of oneself. And there was a back and forth between Brandon and Edelstein. And their correspondence has been posted on the internet, which is pretty interesting to read, where Brandon has a rebuttal to the things that he contends about the self-esteem idea. But I think it's important to look at that definition that Brandon offers and reflect on the value of seeing one's mind as competent to think and to make sense of things, to deal with life's challenges.
Absolutely.
And to honor oneself as worthy of happiness, you know, and that's a subconscious integration as much as it is a sort of explicit belief. You know, if you asked anyone, you think you're worthy of happiness? They would probably respond in the affirmative. But what does that entail in terms of how one reflects on one's mental processes and actions? You know, and that's where the nurturing process of really grokking this need for self-esteem comes in, and focusing on the fact that our emotions are, you know, half of our mental world practically, but yet they've been given really short shrift in this culture, especially with domination structures in their midst. You know, like Rosenberg said, I went to school for 12 years and no one ever asked me what I felt.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have the crushing of that world through the domination systems, and then you have the utter confusion of that world through this phenomenon of the kludge brain, which can make things extra confusing and challenging for people who are trying to walk this path. You know, I think that once you do understand these things, that path is much easier to walk. It doesn't mean that even once you know about the nature of domination systems and how they've affected you and the nature of your own neurology and how that can be a kind of impedance, the frustration doesn't even go away then, you know? So before you come to those revelations, that's a place that I'd really like to help more people get beyond, even though I'm, you know, certainly still on the path myself. But, you know, just pointing out that these things exist and trying to unpack them and explain them, I think is really, really valuable. And, you know, there's so much confusion, too. I mean, I almost have to say in Edelstein's defense, the proper taxonomy of the objectivist world is a little bit difficult to do with all of the schisms and excommunications. It's a little hard to sort everything out, but it can be done. And I think as far as that conflict goes, we can also maybe devote some time to that in the future, because I think that's an exciting sub-project.
Yeah, I can actually agree with Edelstein's solution in this respect. We need to give up on self-rating, you know, rating ourselves good or bad. He actually says instead focus on rating our actions via self-discipline. So there's a lot to unpack there, obviously, but this process of judging ourselves one way or the other, good or bad, right or wrong, can lead to guilt and shame, you know, that really disconnected way of looking at self rather than this nourishing, empowered way of looking at, you know, tragic ways to meet needs, that we need to really be compassionate with these parts of the self that aren't so connected and integrated with the other parts that have the knowledge, that have the understanding. You know, Dan Siegel has that visual where he takes his hand and he puts his thumb across the palm of his hand and then lays his fingers over the top of the thumb. So that's kind of a crude representation of what the brain is. The thumb is like the limbic system where the emotions are. The fingers that go over the thumb is the frontal lobes, the cerebral cortex. And then, of course, the base of the thumb would be the brainstem. And to realize that that evolutionary creation, there's actually a great video, if you want to put it in the show notes, of a person holding a fresh brain that hasn't been put in formaldehyde yet.
Oh.
So it's really soft. And she's describing different aspects of it. But just to look at that and realize that our minds and all of our experiences come from that, you know, set of billions of neuronal connections, trillions even. You know, if there's 10,000 ways that each neuron is connected to other neurons, and to think that evolution has given rise to that, like to be really grateful for however kludgy it is, how amazing it is, all the things that we can accomplish and do and be creative about and express and love, you know, it's just, it's amazing. So gratitude is a really important takeaway from understanding the facets of the kludginess and the domination systems. There's still a lot to be grateful for that we can focus on.